Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, the MBTA will have a new general manager. Luis Ramirez is out after just 15 months on the job.
Well, I certainly would have liked to have seen it last longer.
Our Week in Review panelists on the T's struggle to find a long-term leader. Also today, we visit a lab at Harvard that's trying to rethink how we use buildings.
We're trying to make the very complex, we're trying to make it simple to try to understand it. We have millions of variables in the buildings. We think they are really simple, very, very complex.
And we take a culinary tour of Italy.
For people who haven't been there or haven't traveled extensively in Italy, they don't realize how varied the food is throughout Italy from north to south.
All that deliciousness is coming up next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Friday, Week in Review, MBTA. Luis Ramirez stepped down as the T's general manager after just 15 months on the job. It's the fifth leadership transition at the agency under Charlie Baker's watch.
Well, I certainly would have liked to have seen it last longer.
Former MBTA head Jim Aloisi says Ramirez just wasn't a good fit.
I think this is a classic case of a mismatch of someone's experiences in work and life with the actual job.
Paul Regan, executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board, on the other hand, was taken completely off guard.
I had no problems with him. I don't think the cities and towns had any problems with him. So that's why it's kind of a surprise.
And the governor announced that Steve Poftak will take over at the beginning of next year.
And Steve Poftak, who served on the Fiscal Management Control Board for several years and has been working issues associated with the T literally for 20 years, gets that, understands it, and I believe is the right guy to deliver it.
So we're going to try and make sense of the T here, and joining me now to do that is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Hello, Renee.
Hello, Jamie.
Also with me is Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. Hello to you as well.
Hello, Jamie.
Okay, so I want to read some names here. Beverly Scott, Frank DePaola, Brian Shortsleeve, Steve Poftak, and now Luis Ramirez. What is going on at the T?
And Steve Poftak, too.
Yeah, exactly. Again, Steve Poftak. Charlie, I'll start with you. What's going on there?
Well, look, you know, I mean, it's hard to get somebody to come in and do the job at the T. I mean, transit systems are pretty famous for being not terribly well-functioning, but the T is truly in a class by itself. And so, I mean, to come into a place where you've got, you know, 6,000 employees and only 180 non-union managers, I mean, to sort of drive the kind of changes that need to occur there is a massive job. So I definitely wish Steve the very, very best because it is an incredible undertaking.
So you think it's a pay issue?
No, it's not that. I mean, I think it had been a pay issue because I think that Governor Patrick had slashed the pay so that it was not competitive with other systems. Mm-hmm. Now it's back to where it is competitive with other systems. It's just that I think the level of dysfunction and the degree of the challenge here is probably greater than any place else in the country.
So, Renee, 15 months on the job. There's no real reason given for his departure, but Stephanie Pollack, the transportation secretary, said, Steve Poftak is just a better fit. So, I mean, do you agree with that?
Well, given the fact that Steve Poftak was the interim general manager before Ramirez came in, why wasn't he the correct fit then? You know, I think that's the question. You have to start to wonder about the institution itself, as Charlie mentioned, is a mess.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to also wonder about the decision-making that's going into this and who is choosing these GMs. When Ramirez came in, Charlie Baker said that he was exactly what the MBTA needed. So in 15 months, he clearly became not what the MBTA needed. Now he's saying about Poftak, well, he's the right guy. you know, I'm starting to wonder a little bit about who's making these decisions and why they're making these decisions and why they aren't better thought out.
Well, I mean, Radio Boston, Megan Chakrabarty, Kathleen McNerney here, we did extensive reporting on Ramirez's background when he was chosen in 2017. They found that there were significant questions about his role at another previous place of employment, Global Power, and the company admitted to serious accounting errors over 3 years while he was the CEO. So, I mean, that kind of gets to your point there, Renee, that why was he chosen in the first place? I mean, Charlie Baker, he's Mr. Fix-It.
Yeah.
What happened?
I don't know why he was chosen in the first place, because I think clearly, look, there's a lot of people saying that his problem was that he didn't have transit experience. I think it's more nuanced than that. You know, Brian Shortsleeve didn't have transit experience, and I've been following the T as close as anybody for 20 years, and Brian got more accomplished in his time there mm-hmm. than every other general manager I've seen combined. So I think what it is you have transit experience and you have the local political picture. And I think you can do the job if you don't know one, but when you don't have either, I think that is fatal.
But they actually said, I mean, Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack said that they weren't looking for a transit expert to yep. fill the role when they hired him.
And they didn't get one.
Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, I do want to bring up something that Adrian Walker wrote about this week in The Globe. He sort of connects Ramirez's short tenure to another troubled post, and that's Tommy Chang's time at Boston Public Schools. And he says that Ramirez joins a long list of outsiders who have failed to make it in Boston, that his ouster, quote, only reinforces Boston's reputation as an insular place where only entrenched insiders seem to have access to the secret codes it takes to succeed. Is that a fair read?
I think it can be a fair read. I mean, if you look at what happened to Ramirez and you look at what happened to Tommy Chang, there is this sense that, you know, they bring people in the idea to bring in new blood, which is mm-hmm. which should be good, but then the fit never quite works, or at least the people who hire them suddenly say it doesn't work. You know, what I found a little disconcerting with what happened with Ramirez was, you know, the governor wouldn't admit that a mistake was made. Now, maybe he didn't want to throw Ramirez under the bus, but just say it. You know, this wasn't the best hire.
Well, to be fair, there was an election going on up until last month.
Yes, there was, which Charlie Baker was never going to lose. But, you know, it doesn't hurt to simply say, you know, we made a mistake and we're going to get it right now. I mean, people need to have confidence in the transit system, and they just don't, and they don't have a reason to. And this is part of the reason why.
Charlie?
Yeah, no, I think that certainly there is some truth to the outsiders not being welcome here. But I would also say that, look, at the T, there was progress being made, and that's progress slowed almost to a standstill under Luis Rivera. At BPS, there was progress being made. That pretty much stopped under Tommy Chang. So whether that's, you know, entirely because of the way they're treated as outsiders, I think that probably plays some role in it. But I think there was issues of substance as well.
Well, and there's also the issue of pay, which I know we talked about mm-hmm. a little bit. But so Ramirez's annual salary was $320,000 a year. That was an 80% increase compared to previous GMs, and in part to try to get him to stay longer than everybody else. And earlier this week,
he was only
going
to stay 6 weeks.
Yeah. Then they had to pay out the rest of his contract, right? So earlier this week, Callum Borscher spoke with Richard Davey here on Radio Boston, and Davey has also been the MBTA's general manager, joining another long list. And he says it's got to be about more than just money. There has to be an active effort by the governor.
The kind of folks you're looking for are those who can make more in the private sector. But I think it's probably an appeal to folks who can, give up some of that salary to jump into public service. So I think that's the kind of mix that will happen and probably will require, in particular, the governor personally and the secretary to recruit the kind of right person.
So, Renee, if it's not money, then what didn't they do last time around?
I think they didn't do their homework. You know, I think the fact that Radio Boston was able to find out this information about Ramirez that either the state knew and didn't care about or just somehow didn't find kind of speaks to how this kind of happens. It's just, you know, we're starting to feel like, you know, in the future we will all be MBTA GM for 15 minutes. You know, you can't have this constant turnover and have riders feel secure, have the people who work for the MBTA feel secure. It just feels like nobody's minding the store.
So, okay, so if we're all going to be MBTA GM for a 15 minutes, let's go to the next person who is going to be MBTA GM for hopefully longer than 15 minutes, Steve Poftak. We mentioned him at the top. He's vice chair of the MBTA Fiscal Management and Control Board. He's also been the executive director of the Rappaport Institute at the Harvard Kennedy School. He'll be taking over January 1st, and here's what Governor Baker had to say about him.
The simple truth of the matter is, over the course of the next several years, you're going to see new red line cars, new orange line cars, and hundreds of millions of dollars of investments in signals and tracks and power systems and electronics and all the stuff that's been ignored for years.
So all of that, plus ancient infrastructure, outdated rails and trains, issues with the pension system, unions. Charlie, you've met Steve Poftak before. Do you think he can handle all this?
Look. You know, can anybody handle that? I don't know. I would say this. Steve certainly knows the system. He knows the politics. He is, you know, he'll work hard. He knows the issues. And, you know, I think he's certainly as qualified as anybody to take it on.
The calendar notwithstanding, winter is here. Mm-hmm. That will be his test. The first serious nor'easter that hits the area. Will the tea hold up? We'll see.
But we've said that since 2015.
Right.
This will be the winter that'll break the tea again.
Right. You know, it happens every, and that's the thing. Like, how is it handled? You know, how are delays handled? All those things. It's those, you know, everyday issues that people really care about. And if the sense is that people are, you know, waiting and they're at South Station, they can't get a train, they don't know what's going on, you know, his tenure might be short as well.
Well, you said winter is here, and luckily for people up in the Merrimack Valley, it's mission mostly complete there, as the gas has been restored to 96% of those affected by the explosions back in September. Just today, the last batch of travel trailers, those temporary housing units for Columbia Gas customers who had to leave their homes, they're gone. But Governor Charlie Baker says the company is not off the hook yet.
There's more that remains to be done, but we should take great comfort in the fact that the vast majority of people have been able to return to their warm home and enjoy the remaining holidays and to be with their families.
And Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera praised residents for their strength.
The patience that folks have had is just, I can't even talk enough about it. And so thank you for not rioting, which you would have every reason to have done.
But we talked to Linda Harvey of Debbie's Treasure Chest. It's an organization for at-risk families. And she says the future's still uncertain for many residents up there.
Who pays the mental health counseling? Who pays the physical counseling? How long is Columbia Gas going to be around to really help us?
What about Linda's concern?
It's not a minor thing. I mean, look, do I think it's probably a little premature to hang out the mission accomplished banner? Yes, it is. You know, the progress has been good, but people are still in pretty dire straits in a lot of those areas. You know, they're emotionally and financially. And you can't really overlook that. This is a big deal for a lot of people. And, you know, the sense of security, what's going to happen the next time they turn their stove on? Do they feel comfortable? Do they think they're going to come home again? So there has to be the sense that not only people are held accountable, but that this can't happen again.
Or sleep through the night. We had, you know, folks on our show who said that they were worried sleeping because they just didn't know what was going to happen again.
Right.
Yeah, one of the images that just always sticks with me from this whole debacle was back in September. I've just never seen anything like it, when the Columbia folks couldn't even seem to, you know, to put forth the effort to make it look like they cared about what happened, you know? And that just sticks with me. The more of this that can fall on them, the better. Because I have really never seen anything quite like that.
You know, a few times they made statements like, you know, this could have been worse. Well, you know what? It already was worse for Leo Rondon's family.
Yeah.
You know, and the people who lost their homes. You don't get to say, well, yes, this could have been worse. They should be saying, this should never have happened, and we will ensure that it will not happen again.
And to a degree, I think, given what they actually did, that the fact that it wasn't worse in terms of loss of life and things like that was near a miracle.
Right.
So, but this deadline that they were supposed to hit November and then they moved it almost a month. I mean, I'm sensing from what you guys are saying that you're going to answer this. But how would you characterize their handling of this whole thing? So we've already talked about how they handled it initially, but now here, maybe with the mission accomplished banner out, how have they done?
Poorly. I mean, look, I do think the governor made a good choice at the beginning when he sort of pushed them aside and sort of installed NSTAR to take care of it, because clearly, you know, it was the Keystone Cops with Columbia. So it's not a happy picture.
It's been sloppy.
Yep.
You know, and just this overwhelming sense that they don't really care, as Charlie said. You have this sense where they've been like, okay, what can we do for you? How do we make this better? You know, it seems like an afterthought. And, you know, people lost their homes. Communities were devastated. There are a lot of people who still aren't home yet. Mm-hmm. And what are they doing about that? You know, all people in Columbia, they're comfortably in their homes. They're fine. But they're not really thinking about a lot of families who are really in desperate places still.
Well, and this was sort of something that came up at a hearing this week at the State House on the safety policies of the state's gas utilities. State regulators and executives of five gas companies who do business in Massachusetts, including Columbia Gas, were there. State Senator Michael Barrett led the hearing on Tuesday, and he accused the industry and oversight of the industry as insufficient.
I've got to tell you, I am so tired of hearing about this much-vaunted culture of safety in natural gas utilities. I'm not talking about the DPU. There's no discernible culture of safety that you've inculcated in the utilities that you regulate.
So does Beacon Hill have a responsibility here moving forward in fixing this and making sure that there is a culture of safety for these companies, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, look, Beacon Hill per se can't fix what happened there,
but
I think they
maybe
clearly
the
need
one.
To create an environment in which this doesn't happen again. That is certainly their responsibility, yes.
They need to keep their foot on this company's neck.
Yes.
Period.
I keep coming back to this NTSB report. The National Transportation Safety Board said that safety would have made all the difference in this case. And so should we really be trusting these companies to do it on their own?
You know, it's a tricky question. I mean, on one hand, I don't know how you get that trust back.
Yeah. Once it's gone, you can't regain it.
Right. You know, you hope for the best, but you're never really going to trust them. You know, want to have the sense that there's some sort of oversight that something is going to happen and something's going to change. We'll have to wait and see, but we also hope that while we're waiting and seeing, something else horrible doesn't happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the folks who know something about these natural gas issues, and I'm certainly not one of them, say that the reports say that the idea of having somebody who's a professional engineer having to be in that position to make a decision when it affects public safety, you know, that's what they say needs to happen. So we need
to make
it
happen. Which isn't even required right now.
Right. I mean, yeah. So that's certainly a starting
point. Seems
like
a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Well, I know we have stayed away thus far from national politics, but we're going to touch on it.
Did anything happen this week?
Nothing? I don't know. Well, sort of. Some stuff. It involves some local issues and some local players, including Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton and the presumptive Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. This week, Moulton struck a deal with Pelosi and says he will support her in her bid for the speakership. The two agreed that Pelosi will only serve 4 years as Speaker and that will support a rule that limits any Democratic leader to a maximum of 8 years as Speaker. And then, of course, there was that classic TV moment with Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and President Trump at the White House.
You know, Nancy's in a situation where it's not easy for her to talk right now. And I understand that. And I fully understand that. We're going to have a good discussion and we're going to see what happens. But we have to have border security.
Mr. President, please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as the leader of the House Democrats who just won a big victory.
Did Seth Moulton give Donald Trump a talking point here?
You know, all I kept thinking with everything that happened this week with Nancy Pelosi was this: if you come for the queen, you best not miss.
I saw that on Twitter. Someone was commenting on her jacket.
I mean, it's just, well, the jacket,
that jacket.
That's a whole other segment right there.
And the sunglasses.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, Donald Trump learned what Seth Moulton also learned this week. You know, Nancy Pelosi is no one to be trifled with. And you go, you know, to come at her, you know, you put yourself at great political risk. This was a great week for Nancy Pelosi. You know, she kind of stared down Donald Trump and the opposition to her becoming House Speaker, which was really led by Seth Moulton in not the best kind of way. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that Seth Moulton covered himself in glory this week.
At the same time, she did agree to 4 years, as at the leadership post. I mean, so she gave up something here, Charlie. So could Seth Moulton claim a victory here?
Sure he can. I mean, look, whether it's really a victory or not, you know, who knows? I think there's a couple of perspectives here. I think, you know, from a purely political point of view, well, it's not a victory in Massachusetts. It might, earn him a primary opponent next time around. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that nationally, Nancy Pelosi's not very, very popular. Maybe that's his target in all this kind of stuff. So it really depends on your perspective, what he's sort of valuing the most in this process.
Well, he wrote in a Boston Globe op-ed that he's glad he brought up this fight and that, quote, these conversations have been difficult, but that we're stronger because of them. Do you think the Democratic Party is stronger because of this whole brouhaha?
Look, I think that you're going to have these kinds of fights within the party. I don't know that they're necessarily the worst thing. But, you know, Seth Moulton has to sort of own this. What he wanted was Nancy Pelosi out of that position. He didn't get it. Yes, she agreed to term limits, but in 4 years, she'll be 82.
Right.
She might be looking at retirement at that point anyway.
Right.
So I'm not really sure what he gained. I think he's trying to save face. And, you know, I think he's made himself somewhat vulnerable to a challenger.
Yeah.
But to get back to Charlie's point earlier that, sure, maybe he's more vulnerable to a challenger here in Massachusetts, but maybe this was a shot for a more national audience, a more national presence.
Yeah, I don't think he came out of this looking too great nationally either. I don't. Because, look, if you wanted to do this, you had to come with something more than we want new leadership. Okay, who's it going to be and why do you want new leadership? He didn't do any of that. So it felt very half-hearted. And I think if he'd come with it in a very different way, even if, you know, she stayed speaker, then it could have worked for him. But I don't think it's going to turn out that way.
So if this is even possible, to strip away all of the noise and just take Seth Moulton at his word, my goal has been to have party leadership that reflects the new generation of Democrats in our country and represents the people who voted for change.
Well, look, if that is really what it's about for him, I do have some sympathy for that. I mean, every time I look and they're all up by the dais and I see Steny Hoyer, I expect for them to pan out and Eisenhower is going to be standing there.
There's Grant.
Exactly. So, I mean, I do have some sympathy with that. But again, I just think what it comes down to for the Democrats is simply to say that this is not a time to be squabbling, you know, with what they have ahead, dealing with who they're dealing with. And I think that was really the nub of the fact that Seth Moulton was not very warmly received in his efforts here.
And the good thing is that the squabble at this point is over. It's done.
Right.
They can go into the new year and, you know, put their heads down and do what they say they want to do.
Well, we think it's done, but as we heard in that clip, I don't know, maybe Donald Trump will bring it up again as a sticking point for Speaker Pelosi in the new year.
Well, again, if you're going to come for Pelosi, you better come right. We learned that this week.
Yes, we did.
You get one shot.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to wrap up here with our hubbubs. Everybody loves them. There's those little stories or events that caught your attention this week. So, Renee, what's your hubbub this week?
Okay, my hubbub. You know, we know it's necessary, but nobody enjoys airport security. So the next time you're standing in line at Logan for what feels like forever, perhaps this will help you out a little bit. Boston's Logan has been rated tops by the TSA for having the shortest security wait times in the nation.
What?
I see your face, Jamie. You'll
just
have to believe me on
this. Okay, all right.
Apparently, the wait time is just under 10 minutes. So remember,
how bad is it everywhere else?
Apparently, it's appalling everywhere else. But Boston somehow is getting another 10 minutes. So the next time you're struggling to put your shoes back on, keep in mind that someone else in some airport elsewhere has it far, far worse.
And you don't think it's because everyone here has TSA pre-check or something?
No.
We make up for it.
I never get TSA pre-check.
Yeah. We make up for it, though, because the signage in the central parking is so bad that you lose that 10 minutes just trying to find your terminal from your parking
space.
Where
am I supposed to go? And then the traffic getting to the airport.
Right.
Oh. Although, be nice to fly away to somewhere else. Charlie.
Well, I have an optimistic one. Christmas dreams came true for kids in a town in Western Germany this week when a small technical defect involving a storage tank caused a ton of chocolate to flow out of a factory and solidify on the street. After hitting the chilly pavement, the milk chocolate hardened. About 25 firefighters got the job of prying the coating off with shovels and using hot water and torches to remove the remaining bits. Marcus Lucky, who is the boss at the Dreimeister Chocolate Factory in a town whose name I can't even come close to pronouncing, told a local newspaper that it would have been a catastrophe if the spill had happened closer to Christmas. I suspect that those local kids might disagree with that. I think they probably would have been okay.
Were they able to eat any of it?
Well, they had to go in there and fight the firefighters for it, I think.
Well, didn't something similar happen in Boston like 100
molasses.
Years ago? The
molasses
spill?
Yeah, that's right.
Because who doesn't want chocolate scraped off the ground?
That's right. You know,
that's just the
well,
best.
But it's
those
free.
Top layers.
Oh, right, right.
It's a 10-second rule. 10-second rule. It's fine. Okay, so for my hubbub this week, anyone who knows me knows that I hate it when we have to switch the clocks. Especially when we have to switch back to Eastern Standard Time from daylight saving. It just... This time of year is all so difficult as it is. There's not enough sunlight. It's dark. It's cold. I don't love it. And then we have to change the clocks, and it's difficult. But today, John Chesto at the Globe brought me the good news that I've been waiting for all year. State Senator John Keenan is working on a bill that would keep Massachusetts in Atlantic Standard Time, so daylight saving time, forever. And that is my dream. But there's a catch. We'd only move to the new time zone if Maine, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island do the same thing, and I can just hear my mother's voice in my hand. Well, if Maine and New Hampshire and Rhode Island jump off a bridge, would you? So, and my answer is yes. We should totally do this. I love this idea. No?
Jamie, I hate to burst your bubble, but this bill has been
I know.
Has been proposed every year since I was in high school, I think.
It's the way things are, Jamie. Live it, learn it.
That's
all right. Jamie can dream, I guess. Thank you to our Week in Review guest, Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Thank you to Renee as well.
Thank you, Jamie.
Stay with us. Coming up after the break here, we'll visit a lab at Harvard that's trying to rethink how we use buildings. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Over on Harvard's campus in Cambridge, the university has done something truly exciting. They've retrofit a home so that it has no carbon emissions over its lifetime, and it uses almost no energy for heating or cooling. In fact, it's so efficient, it feeds power back into the grid. And that's all an achievement because...
Buildings, basically, in the United States, consume roughly 42% of the energy cost.
Wow.
So, just heating and cooling.
This is Ali Malkawi.
I'm a professor of architectural technology and also the founding director of the Harvard Center for Green Buildings and Cities. And I'm the creator of House Zero.
He's also an architect and artificial intelligence expert. But what he said there at the end, creator of House Zero, that's the name of their special project and their working lab. And it could offer up a blueprint of how to build or retrofit homes and businesses to be more efficient and more healthy. On its most simple level, House Zero is an office building with comfy, open working spaces and lots of natural light. And from the outside, it looks like the classic 1920s New England wooden house that it once was, but with new windows, rooftop solar panels, a geothermal heating and cooling system, and fresh landscaping. I visited House Zero just a couple of days ago as contractor Dave put the final touches on the gutter system. So if on the outside it looks just like a recently renovated home in that part of Cambridge, it's the inside that is something different.
As you can see, inside, it's like humans, right? There's a skin and there's a lot of veins.
So we're like opened up a cabinet here and there's all kinds of tubes and wires.
We have almost 5 miles of wires in this building.
Miles of cables and custom design software that allows the building to track thousands, millions of data points. It monitors the indoor and outdoor conditions of the house. It can predict the weather each day and self-adjust. It measures humidity, CO2 levels, temperature, energy use, motion, light levels, air quality. As Malkawi explained to me, the heart of the lab's mission is to figure out the best building of the future. And to do that, they are trying to understand how we actually live in and use our homes and offices now.
In homes, you're very much attuned with your own environment. You close the window, you open the window, you know what you have ownership. In commercial institutional buildings, you don't have as much ownership. So you might leave the window, you might not, right? Mm-hmm. So the intention here is to try to automate that.
But understanding how we instinctively live in our spaces and then automating turns out to not be so simple.
We have sensors in the concrete. We have sensors in the walls. We have sensors outside in the facades of the building where we have temperature as well as pressure sensors. It's the layer that would allow us to, for the first time, to understand building behavior and try to demystify its, at least the way that it works, right? We think we understand building behavior well, but there are many complications to it to try to control it, especially in larger structures.
So what would you like to find out from
just
all
open, for example, by itself?
That's what that was.
Yes.
So the windows here in the house are sort of split, maybe two-thirds, a third, and the bottom part looks like it has a handle and you can open it, but the top part is on a hinge and it just opened.
We're in a small conference room here, and what happened is the CO2 level increased. So as the
hot air.
as it got increased, it opened, but it opened very, very slightly, just the right amount for us to breathe better. And it's not going to affect the thermal environment as much. Right away,
it
will
cause. December in Cambridge. It's 30-some-odd degrees outside.
Just gives you the right amount, right? And it will close by itself.
So that window that opened and closed by itself, that's one of the keys to what Malkawi and his team at the Center for Green Buildings and Cities are doing. He points out that our homes used to be more open and connected to the elements. The advent of air conditioning changed that. But in his view, we need to get back to this earlier idea.
We typically have buildings that are sealed, and this particular building is basically very much connected with the outside.
He took me down to what he called the brain of the building to show me exactly how they are studying this.
I'll take you now down very quickly to the brain of the building.
Okay. So now this is, we're going down the central staircase here.
Yes. I'm going to show you now something that is...
This looks like the nerve center here.
It is. And what you're looking at here is the networking. One is to operate the building, and the other one is to command it based on our own research without interrupting the building. We're trying to make the very complex, we're trying to make it simple to try to understand it. We don't have now the capacity to understand things very well. We have millions of variables in the buildings. We think they're really simple, very, very complex.
Now, as he points out, they are a nonprofit, part of Harvard, so they want to make all of this info and data that they'll be collecting moving forward available to everyone, open source. Because the goal is to combine our natural way of living with technology that truly serves us.
In the future, you might say, well, even in a home, you might think you are okay from a health perspective, but these sensors might tell you, you know what, a window should open. Mm. And that, I think it might be a combination between you being able to have a command over your environment as well as a software that nudges you and help you to ensure that, in addition to the energy, I think one of the most important things for us is the building and the environment inside is extremely healthy.
Of course, because I'm sure you're thinking about it too, I asked him what this would cost for the average person to do to their, say, 1920s wooden-framed New England house.
It's a research lab, right?
Sure.
It's an instrumentation. So from a...
The upper level is what you mean, though.
But of course. But if you look into it from a building, home perspective, we really don't have anything. We've got windows, and we've got the geothermal, if you wish to use geothermal. That's it.
So how much are we talking? To get an idea, I think people will be thinking about, maybe I want to do my house like this.
No, if you want to do your house, you think about what kind of technology you want to use. The rest is really instrumentation.
That's Ali Malkawi. He's the director of the Harvard Center for Green Buildings and Cities, and he's the creator and leader of the House Zero Project. We have a ton of pictures of House Zero at our website, radioboston.org. And by the way, before we go to this break, I just wanted to let you know, I did some of my own back-of-the-envelope number crunching because I'm always thinking about costs. So a geothermal system can go for upwards of $25,000 here in Massachusetts. Ballpark another $15,000 to buy a solar energy system. And Malkawi told me they spent about 100,000 on those super efficient state-of-the-art computer-controlled windows. So, if you're at home taking notes and you're thinking of doing these things and nothing else to your home, you'd spend about the same chunk of change as 2 years of tuition, room, and board at Harvard University. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Okay, when I say Italy, what comes to mind? For me, or if you've been there, maybe it's old stucco buildings and cobblestone streets crowded with Vespas and old Fiats and the warm waters of the coast and the beautiful mountaintop vistas. And of course, the food. But Italian food writ large is more than just pizza and pasta with marinara sauce and chicken parm, although I do love me a good chicken parm. It's a tapestry of 20 unique regions, each with their own characters and dishes. And now National Geographic and America's Test Kitchen has journeyed through the old country and brings us their latest cookbook. It's called Tasting Italy, A Culinary Journey, some 100 classic and surprising recipes from all over Italy. And with me in studio now is Jack Bishop. He's the Chief Creative Officer of America's Test Kitchen and one of the authors of this stunning new cookbook. Jack, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jamie. Great to be here.
So we got food in front of us, and we're going to talk about it in a second. But you and your coworkers, what have you done with this book? It is stunning. It's like food porn at its greatest.
Yeah, it started about 3 years ago, conversation with folks at National Geographic and my colleagues at America's Test Kitchen about, wow, like, we do the same thing, but we do it in a really different way, and that we talk about places and bring them to life. And America's Test Kitchen, it's recipes and beautiful recipe food photography. And at National Geographic, it's maps, it's essays by travel writers, and of course, it's stunning location photography. And we said, well, wouldn't that be a really interesting way of telling the story of Italy? Because as far as I'm concerned, Italy is all about the food, the food, and then the
none of the other things.
All right. Well, the art's good.
Yeah.
Right,
okay.
You know,
there's
architecture and all right. You
history,
know, there, all right. And there's clothes.
You know. But, yeah. Legal system. Okay.
But the food.
But the food. You're right. The food wins.
This would be a really great way of telling the complete story in the way of that you couldn't really do in just a sort of standard cookbook, or the way you really couldn't do in a travel essay, and to marry those things so that you could spend hours drooling over photographs, reading, learning things that you never knew, and then you could sort of bring it to life by walking into the kitchen and making recipes.
Yeah. Well, in this book, the pictures, the food, Italy jumps off the pages. And you're actually our first introduction. The first part of the book is a foreword written by you, and you start with your grandmother, Catherine. Can you tell me about her?
Yeah, so my maternal grandmother, her name was Catherine Pizzarello. She was born in New York, but her parents were born in Calabria, down in the south. And she's the greatest home cook in my life, and was a tremendous influence as a kid. And I really didn't even know it. I mean, I was just a hungry kid sitting at the kitchen table with my brother and sister. We weren't allowed to cook with her. We were allowed to watch.
You could only watch? Wow.
You could well, and you know what? Smelling, listening, there was a lot that we were absorbing, but it was not a participatory activity. But she was an amazing cook. Food was incredible. And I just developed this love of cooking. Started cooking as a teenager, went to Italy, lived in Italy in my early 20s, did a tremendous amount of cooking from Italian cookbooks. And so she just instilled that love of food and cooking in me.
And so would it be fair to say that your experience with your grandmother informs your cooking and your book and your career?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, that's early memories, especially food memories, are incredibly powerful.
They are.
And they really shape who you are. I mean, I can still make my grandmother, she's no longer with us, she would be 108 109.
It's possible. She's got enough vowels in her last name.
She got to 99. You know, whatever she was eating was working.
Yeah.
You know, those dishes, whenever I make them, it's like I'm back in her kitchen in, you know, in the 1960s or 1970s, and I'm a kid sitting around waiting for, you know, something to eat. And there was always something amazing to eat.
So what is it about Italian food, or at least Italian-American food, that makes us feel so comfortable, so happy?
Well, the interesting thing is the food that I grew up with and that most Italian Americans grew up with really has no direct analog in Italy. It's very different. I mean, that was always the shock for me when I got to Italy, was like, well, this is not at all the food of my people.
Mm-hmm.
It seems related, but it's different. But what I think really got carried over by Italian immigrants, not only to the United States, but everywhere Italians went, was this just joy of life, and recognition that food is a way to celebrate family and friendship, that it's something that you savor and that should be with company and wine. That's
what we're missing.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, that part of it was always a big part of it, that there was, you know, the table was always full, not only of dishes, but of people.
Mm-hmm.
There was always wine. At least my recollection that's what all of you adults were doing when I was a kid. And I think that is why Italy resonates, because that, you know, la dolce vita. I mean, it's a cliche, but often cliches are grounded in some sort of fact, and that Italians know how to live.
So then, thinking about that, how do you take all 20 regions, all of Italy, all of its culinary diversity, and boil it down to 100 recipes?
It was really challenging. The original list was 400. And so
doesn't seem like enough there either.
No, that's not enough. But we said, so for each of the 20 administrative regions, and the book is organized north to south, mm-hmm. that we wanted to choose recipes that really felt distinct to that area. Because that's the really interesting thing about Italy, is that the food is really quite diverse. You've got the fact that Italy is a north to south country.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's not a huge country, you have a very diverse set of climates and topography and geography, which influences all the cheese and the butter in the north, and all of the tomatoes and garlic and chili peppers in the south. So we're like, what are those dishes from the Piedmont, from Tuscany, from Calabria, that really feel like tell the story of the local ingredients, the local traditions? We also wanted to build a cookbook, so we didn't want 100 pasta recipes, as much as I love pasta. Felt like, well, we needed to have sweet things. We needed to have antipasti. We needed fish. So, you know, it works that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really fun. I mean, the cooking in the kitchen, a lot of these dishes, many people at America's Test Kitchen had never tasted before, because they're very much local dishes that haven't gotten to Boston.
Like,
or,
what? Like, name a few of them. I'm curious what those might be.
So a dish from Puglia that's made with dried fava beans and potatoes. So think about mashed potatoes meets hummus in some way. So
that sounds delightful.
And then, no, it gets better. Then you saute escarole with a lot of garlic, and you put that on top. And so it's this creamy, beany, earthy, potato-y, warm, delicious. Oh, and there's a lot of olive oil, of course.
Do you scoop it? How do you eat it?
Yeah, it's a side dish.
Yeah, it's
You know, but it's like mashed potatoes and garlicky greens, but it's all one. And then there's dried fava beans, which is supplying its own flavor. And so that's like a dish I had actually had before. But I think I may have been the only person in the Test Kitchen who had ever had that dish, because it's a dish that really doesn't get that far out of Apulia.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we're talking about food, because we did our requisite 8 NPR minutes of intellectual talk of Italy. So let's go to the food. I spent some quality time this week cooking, and there are pictures, by the way, of the recipes that we're about to talk about on our website. And I want to start with the chicken liver crostini. And you describe it in the book as a classic recipe from Tuscany, and it was a challenge for me. I love cooking. Full disclosure, I'm Italian American, Sicilian American, and so, you know, I wanted to try something that wasn't from Sicily, and I've never cooked livers before. Can you just tell us a little bit about what goes into this recipe?
So it starts with chicken livers.
Yeah.
They're at your supermarket. You just need to look for them. They're usually in a container. They are lightly sautéed.
I'm going to give you some here.
Butter, sage. There's onion in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's white wine. It's not all that different than perhaps what you might get in a French recipe.
But it's chunky.
It's chunky. So once you sauté them, and the key here is to not overcook the chicken liver, you throw it in the food processor, and it's not a smooth, creamy puree. It's rustic. The thing about Tuscany is, you know, we think of Florence. Thank you. You know, I just have to say that, like, as the food person, generally when I go radio, television, I'm the person who has to cook.
Yeah.
Well, that's generally the way this works. And so thank you. You cooked for me.
Well, I'm Italian-American. You can't come to my table, and I can't have you come here with no food on the table. I should have brought wine. You're right, though.
It's Friday afternoon.
Yeah, it's true. We got some time for the wine.
So
I made this last night.
Yeah, so Tuscany is a place of frugality. It wasn't actually, yes, I mean, the Renaissance and all the wealth that seems to be implied by all the, you know, the gold and the that's there was the high point. And, 19th century Tuscany was a very poor place. And so the rest of Tuscans are known as bean eaters, which is like a derogatory that other Italians use about Tuscans because they were so poor they had to eat beans all the time. So that also meant things like, okay, how do we, turn the chicken livers? We're not only going to roast the chicken or braise the chicken, but we're going to do something with the offal.
Yeah.
And those liver are not going to waste. So I'm going to taste.
Okay.
And give you the honest opinion.
All right. Be kind. Again, I made it last night. Post the holiday party.
The fact that you're cooking after your holiday party, I mean, I'm worried you didn't have enough fun at the holiday party.
No, I did. I had fun, and you know what? I was done, so it was a good excuse to get home.
It's delicious.
Yeah, and I had fun making it. It didn't take very long, and that's what I mean, it was simple ingredients, and it was fun to make. So thank you for bringing it to me as an idea.
And I would say excellent execution.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, let's see how you feel about the next thing. So I also went further north to Piemonte for a chocolate hazelnut cake that's also here in the book. And, well, first, I mean, I was expecting Nutella to be an ingredient, but it wasn't.
So this is the Piedmont in the Northwest, is where Nutella comes from, mm-hmm. the spread that is made with hazelnuts, a local ingredient, and chocolate, which, of course, they're not – chocolate doesn't grow in the Piedmont, but they are manufacturing it. It is a center of Italian candy making. And so, we're using the constituent ingredients. There are hazelnuts in this cake, and there is bittersweet chocolate rather than the Nutella. And it's it's a flourless cake mm-hmm. that we added a little bit of flour to for a better texture. It has 2 tablespoons of flour. But it is a cake that relies on egg foam. So many cakes, you're adding baking powder and or baking soda to get that leavening. This is an egg foam cake. So you're separating the whites from the yolks. You did it. You know what you did.
I did. And I've never done it before. So,
Well, I have to say, I think you used a pan that was smaller than we suggested.
I did. So apartment living, I had an 8, and I had an 8 and a 10-inch pan, and you suggested 9.
Yeah. So you went smaller.
Yeah.
So it's taller. It's dusted with confectioner sugar.
Yeah, I was trying to cover up the top here, yeah. And we'll put a picture of this on the website so you could compare it to what it's supposed to look like.
Well, those cracks are not a mistake. There's fissures in the top of this cake because it's leavened, as I said, with the egg foam. So it rises and then it does collapse a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And when it collapses, there's some fissures. I'm a little worried about some of the structural issues around the periphery of the cake.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I didn't fully understand what you were talking about with the parchment paper in the recipe, which, again, is on our website. But so I may have messed that up, and I apologize.
Oh, so we're going to need to do a parchment tutorial?
I guess. I'm used to making things like our third recipe here, which is caponata from Sicily. It took every fiber of my being to not just make my mother's caponata and bring it in.
I actually did go and make some with her this week as well, just to have some. But I made your recipe, and caponata, can you just quickly explain what the idea behind caponata?
So it is the eggplant relish from either Calabria or Sicily. Mm-hmm. And since, you know, my relatives are from Calabria and yours are from Sicily, so we're not going to get into that. Nope. But it is sweet and sour.
Super cordial, yeah.
So as opposed to ratatouille, for instance, it's got bigger, bolder flavors, I think. It's got brown sugar, red wine vinegar, pine nuts, raisins, olives in it. What I think is interesting, and I want to hear your take, and I want to hear your mother's take on how we deal with the eggplant.
I could not believe I had to put the eggplant in the microwave. But I did it. I followed your instructions, involved coffee filters and microwaving with the eggplant.
Yeah, and so what we're doing here, and it's not the health thing. I mean, yes, you end up sauteing the eggplant in less oil. So what you're doing is you're salting the eggplant, spraying the coffee filters with vegetable oil and then nuking it. But that's so you can taste everything else rather than the oil. So you can taste the olives and the capers and the delicious vinegar and sugar.
Well, in a mere seconds, we're going to get to try all of this. Jack Bishop, Chief Creative Officer of America's Test Kitchen, and together with National Geographic, they're out with the new cookbook, Tasting Italy, A Culinary Journey. It's beautiful. There are pictures and recipes on our website. Jack, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Jamie.
That's Radio Boston for today and this week. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.